BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the actor Wendell Pierce. His credits include roles in more than 30 films and 50 TV shows. He starred as Meghan Markle's father in the legal drama Suits, but it was as Detective Bunk Moreland in The Wire that he helped redefine the boundaries of what television could be. If The Wire was novelistic, then the follow-up Tremé, written with him in mind, was poetic, a polyphonic tribute to the resilience and cultural riches of Pierce's home city of New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Born in 1963, Wendell and his family lived in Pontchartrain Park, the first middle-class African-American suburban-style development in the city. At the time, schools were still segregated, and his parents' stories of the Free Southern Theatre, a civil rights theatre group, left him with a sense that even in extreme circumstances, art matters. It was a lesson that would play out in his own life when Katrina destroyed his neighbourhood, and he was inspired to act in more than one sense of the word. He says, in American culture, we've turned away from an awareness of the prophetic power of art, of its role as a means of revealing the hidden order beneath everydayness and its power to transform us and the world. Art doesn't give us life's answers as much as the power to live life's questions. Wendell Pierce, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
So you're accomplished in film, TV and on stage. Tell me a little bit about that working trifecta. How do you keep it in balance?
I shoot for that trifecta. I want to do a play and do some television and a film every year. I think diversity has been the key to me having longevity in my career. Mm. You don't want to be the theater snob that I was when I was coming out of Juilliard. Oh, I only want to do theater. Young actors always make that mistake. It's really about good material and good writing.
Was theater your first love?
Yes, it was. I came home one summer between fifth and sixth grade. I guess I would have been around 11 years old. And I told my mother I didn't want to go to a summer day camp, which you would go to in New Orleans. And she said, well, you know, the rule in this house is you got to get out and get a job. And you're too young to get a job. So I went to the University of New Orleans and there was a theater camp. And I had a great time. And then the woman called me back to be in her thesis play, Midsummer Night's Magic. She stole a good title, right? And a little boy lost in the woods who then encounters all of these different animals. And it was absolutely fantastic. I got the bug.
You've starred in some hugely popular, critically acclaimed shows. Mm-hmm. How do you know? Do you know when something's going to be a hit?
I don't. I remember when I first saw The Wire, we saw the first two episodes. And I was sitting there with two other cast members. And I said, oh, my goodness, I hope you guys save your money because we're going to be canceled immediately. This is not very good. You know, it's too slow. And it wasn't until after the first year and the midway in the second year that we started to realize that people were responding to it. But even throughout all five seasons, David had to pitch it to HBO to produce us again. And now here it is decades later, where people are still appreciating it, and it has reached the acclaim that it has.
Mm. And what about radio? That's another string to your bow, isn't it?
Yes. That was my summer job in college. When I went to New York, I went to Juilliard, and I used to come home in the summers and work at WYLD, FM 98, music FM. It's 20 minutes after the hour. I'm Wendell Pierce. And it started because I went to the program director. I had an idea for a show. I was 16. And he said, well, let me teach you radio. You know, and so I would go in on Saturdays and do production stuff. And then one day he said, hey, guy's going to be out tonight. Do you want to go on the air? And I said, absolutely. He said, I was so young. He said, call your mother and let me get the approval. And I went on like at midnight.
Music is another passion of yours. How has it been putting this list together of tracks to share?
This has, putting this list together, there's so much music I had to cut out. And I thought it was torturous, you know, and And at the same time, the songs that I selected, I realized, I'm very melancholy. You know, I think I'm depressed. Maybe it's because I'm working on Willie Loman.
I think Death of a Salesman would invite a certain amount of introspection.
Yes. You know, a little too much at times.
Well, with that in mind, let's hear your first choice. What have you gone for your first disc?
When I think of this track, I think of my childhood. I think of all the things that were great about it. Growing up in New Orleans, a very musical city. But being in a deep South, a little black boy growing up, is told, if not directly, but indirectly, that they are subpar, that they are not enough, that they are less than, that you aren't valued. My parents did a great job to make sure that I knew I was valued, that I knew that I had purpose and that life was going to be special for me. But this song kind of captured it. You know, I felt alone at times, as though I was less than. And then the reinforcement and love of my parents and friends and who I knew and my teachers, I realized that I was someone of purpose and promise and importance. And that was captured in It's Not Easy Being Green.
When green is all there is to be, it could make you wonder why. But why wonder, I'm green and it'll do fine. It's beautiful and I think it's what I want to be.
Jim Henson as Kermit the Frog singing Being Green. Oh, Wendell
that,
Pierce.
That really was just like my shield. That was my armor. I'm okay being green. I mean, it's a little on the nose when it comes to being in the midst of racial conflict and prejudice. You know, I think of they had this awful thing in the South of rubber little head for luck.
Mm.
So I was always suspicious of men coming up and, hey, buddy, how you doing?
Ruffling
because
your hair.
It literally was, and I'm going to say it because it should be said, rub a little nigger's head for luck. And so as a child, being suspicious of the intent of men around me, knowing that if I reacted in a violent way or, you know, in an angry way, they would be like, what's the matter? I do that with my son, you know? They would feign some sort of ignorance of the put-down that they're doing of you. And to know that something, a song as simple as that from Sesame Street, can embolden a child and protect a child from the ugliness of racism and prejudice and discrimination. It shows you the power of art.
I want to ask you about some of the roles that brought you into so many of our living rooms, starting with The Wire. Between 2002 and 2008, you played Detective Bunk Morland alongside Dominic West as your on-screen partner,
yes.
Jimmy McNulty.
Yes.
I feel like I have to sit in Bunk's voice.
Right.
David Simon was not so much writing a TV drama as a systemic examination of an entire city, in this case, Baltimore, one of the most critically acclaimed TV dramas ever. What do you remember about reading the script for the first time, meeting Bunk for the first time?
I thought the script was amazing. I thought it was a real examination of the dysfunction in the corporate world, in the political world, in the criminal justice world, and a real criticism of the decline of the American empire, really. There's so much in the political, economic, and criminal justice systems that are eating away at the very best of America and its people. He captured all of that in just the simplest scenes of some kids who are explaining what chess is and how we're the pawns. That's the king and queen there.
Mm.
You'll never pass some kid on the corner who is being a part of some underground drug deal and not see his full humanity. That's the writing that was there. And when I saw that, I realized I wanted to be a part of it. And it changed my life.
Didn't you say I was born to play Bunk?
Yes, I did. I said that out of necessity to move everyone else out of the way. But what happened was I knew so many men like Bunk, and then I got to meet so many men like Bunk, and I got to meet the real Bunk.
So who is the real Bunk?
Rick Requeir. He was fantastic. He took me around. I did drive-bys with him. He was about to retire when we started the show. And he took me to the different police stations, and we talked about why he became an officer, and I did all that research. Cut to our last year shooting. I went to his retirement party, and he said, "Come here, boy." And I came over ready to be chastised. And he said, "You made me a star." And I was like the prodigal son coming home. And he hugged me. And, you know, he reminded me, and there's so many men like, especially for African-American officers, that they became police officers because the criminality that was happening in their neighborhoods did not reflect the community that they knew. People that got up every morning trying to make a living and raise families and just make the best of it. Mm-hmm. And he said, "That's why I became a police officer." So I wanted to be those men, and I felt as though I knew those men. And that's why I said I was born to play Bunk.
Many listeners will also be familiar with your role as Robert Zane in Suits, Meghan Markle's dad in the US legal drama. Not many people have walked a future royal up the aisle as you did in that show.
I know.
Sorry for the spoiler. What was it like working together?
Oh, it was great. Working with Meghan was wonderful. She's a really good actress and was always sweet, always kind. I didn't believe she was dating the prince when it first started. And everyone said, "Yeah, she's dating." I'm like, "Yeah, right." Couldn't believe it. And then one day I looked up and there was this real MI5 sort of security guard with us from London with this British accent. And I said, "Oh, it must be true." And then I knew it was. And we were shooting one day before the engagement. In the show, she was engaged and she had a ring on. And we were about to get out the car and I said, "Don't get out. Give us the ring. There's a paparazzi down the street. If a photograph got out with you with a ring on it, it would explode all over the world." And then when we had the final scenes, I said, "Listen, your world is going to be forever changed. And no matter where you are, you can always know you have a friend in me." That was the last time, you know, I got to speak with her. So it was great.
It's time for your next piece of music. This is your second disc. Tell us about this one.
This is a song that reminds me of New Orleans. It starts off with that big four beat that is so classic in New Orleans music. I can take you to where jazz was born, literally on Rampart Street, outside of the French Quarter, where captured Africans found their creative freedom before their actual freedom, because on Sundays they would play that African six, and then you would hear the oom-pa-pa of the European brass, and they put that together and made jazz. And so I wanted to make sure that I have some connection to home when I was on the island. And this particular song has that big four beat at the beginning, and it is a Thelonious Monk tune from the bebop era in the 40s, but it's played by a friend of mine from childhood, and that's Wynton Marsalis, the great jazz trumpeter. And I've watched him these 40 years, and to see the embodiment and genius in someone, it's an epiphany about what is possible in humanity. And I would like to hold on to that if I was alone on this island. This song is also very hopeful. It's swinging. And this is Green Chimneys.
Wynton Marsalis playing Thelonious Monk's Green Chimneys. Wendell Pierce, I notice you conducting to the music today. You've got some skills there.
I was an usher at the Juilliard Theatre, so I saw all the great conductors when they came through.
Well, let's go back to New Orleans then. You were born there in 1963, mm-hmm. the youngest of three sons. Your father, Amos, had been a private in the US Army fighting in the Second World War, and mm-hmm. he won a few medals that he didn't collect for many years. Did he raise you and your brothers to be patriotic?
Yes. My father used to have a saying, you can't get lost in America. He used to say it on our summer trips in the car, but really it was emblematic of what he thought about the country. Like, you can find your way in America in spite of everything. America has a great debt to African Americans. In spite of everything the country has done to us, we still have been devoted to the country generation after generation after generation. Somewhere in the middle of the 1850s, my great-grandfather was sold as a baby with his mother. And his first memories of seeing his brothers and sisters on the banks of the river in tears as he was sold from one white man to another white man and ended up on Bayou Lafourche in Assumption Parish, Louisiana, where our homestead is. And at night, his mother would say prayers and say, you have brothers and sisters and a father in Kentucky. If you ever get free one day, go back and find them. He never did. And in spite of all of that, my father willingly went to fight for a country that on paper, it says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and every man is equal. That is how my father taught me about America. He said, it's a great country because of what we do with it. But the values that we believe in, this is what we believe in, that equality, that's what we fight for. Our families trying to stay together over the course of all of these years of violence and antagonism, that's America to me. And that's the sort of patriotism he gave to me. I remember one night we were at a fight, a boxing match, and it was around the time of Black Power Movement. And these brothers sitting in front of us pulled on my dad's pants during the national anthem. He said, sit down, man. What are you doing standing for the national anthem? He said, listen, I fought for that flag. So you could sit down and not stand up. He said, but you pull my pants again, I'm going to kick you in the teeth. Right? So it was that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. He didn't get his medals. He fought in Saipan and came back. My mother came to me just a couple of years ago before she passed. And she came to me and she said, Wendell, your father got medals in Saipan.
He thought he got like two, right?
He got like two. Yeah. Ended up being like seven. And he said when he was being discharged, as they were processing him, he said, I think my unit won medals. And a white female officer told him, yeah, right. You won medals. Impossible. And he was angry and said, well, I don't want them. I don't need your medals. My mother said, we got a letter from the Army saying that he has these medals and they want to get it to him. Would you look into it? And I thought my mother would bring me something she had just received, and she brought this yellowed piece of paper from January 1945 saying that he had the medals. And I was like, oh, my goodness, this is 2010. Mm. So with the help of the World War II Museum in New Orleans, we talked to the Department of Defense and got his medals, and they awarded him his medals on Veterans Day in 2010. At the gala, he said he wanted to speak. He said, I always wanted to speak. I said, all right, we'll speak. And he hobbled to the microphone. He says, you know, when I went off to war, I thought I'd never see the country again. And we've come a long way. We have a black president now. I never thought I'd see that ever. And he said, as much as this country has done to me and how I was denied these medals at first, I can now say, and he stepped back, saluted, said, God bless America. That's what he taught us. Love the country and challenge it at the same time.
The neighborhood where you grew up is so essential to your story. You've said that Pontchartrain Park's ordinariness made it extraordinary.
Yeah.
Why?
Because during the height of segregation, Pontchartrain Park was created in 1955. A black person couldn't even go into a green space, a park, except one day a week, Negro Day. Because of the civil rights advocacy, we fought. And Pontchartrain Park was created to appease the movement. It was separate but equal. It was still an ugly thing. They had a dividing line, a ditch, actually, that still exists today between the white neighborhood and the black neighborhood, segregated. So we took something ugly and made it beautiful. And it became an incubator of talent, of teachers, of doctors, of lawyers. And in the midst of this ugliness, this Moses generation gave us, this Joshua generation, an upbringing that felt like Americana, a small town.
Let's hear some more music.
Yes.
Tell us about this next one.
Okay, this next song was me at my youthful best, at my cockiness. I could not be told anything. It was my coming of age. I can remember it is perpetual spring and summer when I hear this song. It is the groove of who I am. I am strong. I'm beautiful. My best days were ahead of me, and I knew it. All my boys became men when we heard this song, and we were unified in the funk. And this is One Nation Under the Groove by the Funkadelics.
So I can't get around it.
So low, you can't so get under it. Get under
so it. High, you can't get over
so
it.
So high, you can't get over it.
This is a chance. This is a chance.
Funkadelic and One Nation Under a Groove. So, Wendell Pierce, we talked about your dad. Tell me a little bit about your mum, Althea. She's a school teacher, right?
Yes, she was a school teacher, Althea Pierce. I called her T. My mother, like all mothers, are just angels. Education was the most important thing. When she was sent off to school, everyone made fun of her father, my grandfather, saying, what are you sending those girls to school for? And he said, no, that's the most important thing. She came to New Orleans from Assumption Parish because it was the only black high school that was available to her at the time. They didn't have one out there. They met my father at Southern University, a historic black college in Baton Rouge. And then she started her teaching career. She taught at Cog Hill Elementary School, which is right in my neighborhood.
So did she teach you? Did she teach at your school?
It wasn't allowed, just in case there was a nepotism or something. I was at school with her, so all of my teachers were her friends. So all of my teachers then were at my in my mother's living room, you know. And so I would come home, and in the living room, you know, my third grade teacher, Miss Butler, would say, Pierce, he has homework. Don't let him tell you he doesn't have homework. She taught just two blocks from my home in my elementary school. And education was of so much importance because she realized that that was the real armor to face the world.
You went to a predominantly white school when you were a little bit older.
Yes.
So, how did that come about?
So it came about when it was the gifted and talented program. So they had just started that with me, and I was bused to a predominantly white school where the program was starting. And my father had the talk with me.
So the talk, for listeners who don't know what the talk is, can you explain?
The talk to me was not about sex. It was about the first time you were going to encounter, probably, racism. At the time, I saw busing happening in Boston and the buses being attacked.
Yes, because schools were being desegregated. Yeah.
And so black kids being bused into other schools, I was seeing them being attacked on television news. And so my father said, listen, I want to talk to you. Now, you're going to school out there and you're going to get your ass kicked. I said, what? He said, oh, yeah. He said, these white boys are going to come at you in a group. They always do. It's always going to be in a group. He said, now, you're going to get your ass kicked, Wendell. But in the middle of that, you grab the biggest one or the leader. And while you're getting your ass kicked, you kick his ass. And then he'll say, all right, we got Wendell. Leave him alone. And they'll never fool with you again.
You must have been terrified.
I was absolutely terrified. I was like, what? What are you sending me into? A war zone? I couldn't believe it. So I got off the bus the first day, and the kids were like, hey, Wendell, how you doing? All of a sudden, I'm beating a kid up. And I had to fight every day for the first week. And I was like, you know, the principal was, Ms. Garcia was like, oh, Wendell is such a good student. And the kid I'm sitting next to me in the principal's office said, what are you talking about? He's been fighting every day since he came here and got off that bus.
You were like a coiled spring.
I was a coiled spring, ready to pounce. A couple of months later, we were playing Kill the Man with the Ball, our version of rugby, right? And a kid, Chet, never forget, yelled out, niggas against the whites. And there was this silence. And I said, this is it. This is it. It's just three of us. Mm-hmm. We're back to back. They encircled us, and I focused on Chet. I could hear my father now, the biggest one or the leader. They're probably the same one. I'm like, come on, Chet. Oh, I'm going to get you. And I turned into this devil. This is the moment I've been waiting for. This is the epiphany. Yes. Come. And three ran in. All the other kids, maybe one or two, ran towards us. They said, this kid is crazy. I grabbed Chet and I wailed on him. And Chet got up and said, all right, that's enough. And for the next 2 years, we all played. We were friends. And I think about it years after, and I said, my father's attempt to shield me, embolden me, empower me, it was weird and wrong. And I know Chet's parents had told him a certain thing. But we became friends, and we played for years after that. But it just shows you the ugly, insidious nature of racism and white supremacy.
I mean, for all of the prejudice that was still existed, your generation was also among the first to experience new freedoms that people had been fighting for a long time, you know,
yes.
including your parents.
And it gives you a great responsibility that this Moses generation had given this Joshua generation so many gifts to go ahead with.
Was that a lot of pressure? How aware were you of that fact that, you know, you were special? You were experiencing these new things and afforded possibilities and aspirations that had been denied to people for a really long time.
I think my mother's focus on education was so important. That was the pressure more than anything. She said, you will absolutely dishonor all those who came before you if you did not get your education. You know, it was against the law to learn how to read and write. My grandmother got her high school education at the age of 69 because in Louisiana she couldn't go past the sixth grade, you know. Mm. And my mother was right. She was a blessed woman.
It's time to go to the music. What's next?
This song is that hope and optimism that my mother gave me. It reminds me of my mother. I would want to have that loving memory on this island. And it is connection to family, because from generation to generation, this song is played as one passes on in our family. And this woman was from New Orleans. And this is Take My Hand, Precious Lord by Mahalia Jackson.
Jackson and Take My Hand, Precious Lord. Wendell Pierce, by the time you discovered your love of acting, you began to split your school days. So you'd go to high school part of the time and then the New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts the rest of the time.
Right.
How did that work and how was that for you?
It was brilliant because Benjamin Franklin High School was a college prep. You know, it was really, really tough preparing you for college. I went to NOCA, and I remember the first thing they said there is, if you're going to be a professional artist, you're probably going to have to leave Louisiana. You know, and that's tough for a lot of people, kids, to think about. Most of you will not graduate from here because we're going to treat you like professional artists and have great expectations. So two institutions that were very, very intense and serious.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, hearing that, what was that like for you? I loved it.
That was exactly the ethos that my mother was espousing. And so I graduated from both and I was accepted into Juilliard.
It was incredibly difficult to get into Juilliard. I mean, before we talk about that, I just want to ask you about a trip to England that you took when you were a teenager.
Yes.
That was quite important for you. It was a bit of a turning point.
So while I was training at NOCA, I came here to London when I was 16 years old. I saw As You Like It at the Royal Shakespeare Company. I saw Evita on the West End. I saw Yul Brynner in The King and I on the West End. And I saw The Mousetrap even. And I realized, man, people here in London and in England go to the theater the way we look at television. And I just, in that moment, knew I could be an actor.
What about that experience made you think I could do that? Because I don't think everyone else would necessarily have that response.
Because I understood what the classes we were being trained in, I saw it actualized on the stage here. There wasn't that much theater and that level of professional theater in New Orleans. There was community theater, but to see it on that level, on the commercial level, to see it in the repertory companies, and I realized, okay, there is a professional theater world that I can aspire to. And that was great. I was motivated in New Orleans by the Free Southern Theater, which was a company that had gone around the country during the Civil Rights Movement, and they would do plays, you know, during the marches. And so I knew that that existed. You can't make your living on that. And then when I saw the commercial theater here, I realized, oh, wow, that is something that is a possibility. You know, I would take my chances on whether or not I was good enough, but I knew now I had a focus and a goal to my training.
So you got into Juilliard. When would that have been? New York City, 1981, when you arrived.
New York City, 1981.
Curtis Blow has just released The Breaks not long before. I mean,
I remember going to Danceteria, man. I remember seeing Mary J. Blige, and Jay-Z was actually still slinging, I think, over at Marcy Apartments. So I'm a big jazz head, so I was going to all the jazz clubs and stuff. But, you know,
you're only 17 at this point,
right? I'm 17, yourself. But I was hanging out with all of these jazz musicians who had come up. Winton was at Juilliard, and now he was starting to play with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. I would go to his apartment, and we would, you know, sit at the feet of Art Blakey as he was just talking about the world and everything, you know, and artistry and what it takes to be a musician. So it was just real coming of age. I really saw what it took to be an artist, and at 17, living in New York and going to school at Juilliard was absolutely amazing time.
Tell us about your next piece of music.
Now, this next piece of music is, first of all, it's just a beautiful, beautiful song. It says so much about me. I always think of love when I think of this song. Love to me is so multifaceted and painful. And what is life but love? And I'm a sentimentalist, as you can hear in the conversation and in the selections. And this song is sustenance to that sentimentality and love and life. And the last lyric says it all. I really don't know life at all. And that's Both Sides Now, Joni Mitchell.
But now old friends are acting strange. They shake their heads. But something's gained in living every day. I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions. I recall I really don't know life. And
Joni Mitchell and Both Sides Now. So Wendell Pierce, you once said that getting into the elite Juilliard Performing Arts School was confirmation that my heart had spoken to me and it had not lied. What were your expectations by the time you left?
I knew my heart had spoken to me because of my vocation. Real, focused, serious concentration on craft. You have to deal with your inadequacies. And when I left Juilliard, the one thing that was clear was I wasn't an actor. I went in with all the confidence in the world, and I came out of it thinking there was so much work to be done. I'm sure that I wasn't an actor. There was a sense of the imposter syndrome. Actually, I still have a little bit of that. I had to overcome it.
How?
When in doubt, do the work. When in the deepest doubt, work even harder.
Yeah.
And when I got out of school, my first job, I thought I was going to go back to do radio. And then I got a job and I said, no, that was a fluke. And then I got another one. I was that was a fluke. And by the end of my first year, I said, stop. You're a professional actor. And once I declared it to myself and understood this mantra that I live by, employment doesn't define you as an artist. And it's important to know that when you're unemployed, obviously. But it's also important when you are employed, because you have a lot of yes people, you know, you're the best thing since sliced bread. But you have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and to thine own self be true.
It sounds like you knew how to ace auditions back then.
Yeah.
Do you have any really memorable ones? What's your best audition?
My best audition is one of the highlights of my career. I always tell people, auditions are your opening and closing night. And if something comes of it, then that's lanyap, as we call it in New Orleans. A little something extra.
Okay.
Lanyap.
Lanyap.
I had an audition for Big Deal, a new musical on Broadway being done by the one and only Bob Fosse.
Wow.
And I had read Michael Shetler's audition book, and people had talked about all these little tricks they had done. And one in particular stuck in my head, so I decided to do it. They were coming out of rehearsal. It was on a break, and I was coming in to audition. And it's the moment in the musical where this boxer takes his life back from the mob, who's kind of controlling him and telling him when he should take a dive. And going, no, this is it. I'm going to take my life back. I'm going to live my life. And so I came in. They were taking a break, and all the actors and dancers and musicians were walking out. I said, hold it, everybody. This is it. I'm going to take back my life. Jim, you do this. Jackie, you do that. This is my life. Bob Fosse says, oh, hold it, hold it, hold it. All right, everybody go to break. Come on, step up, young man. And then turns to the accompanist on piano and he says, give me an F vamp. Bump, 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 bump. And the stage manager is fumbling through the pages. He doesn't know what to do. Bob Fosse says, hold it. And he walks up to me and says, all right, start. And I said, all right, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to take back my life. Jim, you do this. Jackie, you do that. I'm taking back my life. And he said his lines, and he circled me, and I said, where are you going? I'm taking back my life. And I did the whole scene with him. He came up to me, nose to nose, and he said, you're good, but you're too young. And I'm like, oh. He said, oh, yeah, you're too young for this. I got to find something for you, but you're too young. He said, I tell you this, man. I'm going to look for something for you. I said, oh, thank you, Mr. Fosse, thank you. And I walked out, and I got home. My agent called me and said, what did you do? She said, oh, I can't believe it, because Bob Fosse called you. And he said, you were good, but you were too young. And he says he promised he's going to work with you this year.
Did he?
Cut to me in a hotel room in Washington, D.C., about to go to work on another play. I look on the television. I see the picture of Bob Fosse. I turn the television up, and they said, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Fosse died today. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Bob Fosse died, and I was going to work with him. I was going to work with him. And then I realized, wait a minute. I did work with him. We had an audience of maybe two or three, but I got to work with Bob Fosse.
It's time for your sixth disc. What are we going to hear and why have you chosen it?
I am a fallible man. I won't speak of all the failures I've had in my life, but the greatest is when you fail with the people you care about. And I think of family, mostly. When there's dysfunction, you just want it to be healed. And the word that has been on my mind so much is redemption. And this song is the epitome of redemption. And, you know, the blues idiom, the idea of the blues idiom is not that you are troubled and you have no recourse, but that you can do something about it no matter what. I ain't got no shoes, but I'ma still walk to Chicago. That's the true blues idiom. It's not just pathos. There's promise. And that is embodied in this song. And it's called Don't Give Up On Me. Solomon Burke.
If I fall short, if I don't make the grade, if your expectations aren't met in me today, there's always tomorrow, or tomorrow night, hanging there, baby. Sooner or later, I know I'll get it right. Please don't give up on me. Oh, please don't give up on me.
Solomon Burke and Don't Give Up On Me.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, plaintive.
Okay, Wendell Pierce, I want to take you back to New Orleans.
Yes.
August 2005.
Mm-hmm.
So you made out of the city when Hurricane Katrina hit, but you didn't really then have any idea of the impact, the devastation that was going to follow.
No, I came in that Saturday for a family vacation. I was on my way to Baltimore to start the season of The Wire. And I got to the airport and I arrived. I was crazed. And I said, what's going on? They said, the hurricane is coming. I said, what hurricane? The one in Florida? He said, yeah, it turned. It's heading this way. And I got home and my mother said, oh, this one is serious. I think we should leave. And I said, oh, no, we don't have to leave. Listen, if there's a mandatory evacuation, we'll leave. I said that because I thought there's never been a mandatory evacuation. It won't happen. The next day, there was one. And so we left. We were still in the storm, sheltered at my uncle and aunt's home on the Mississippi River. And the storm passed through. We're all listening to the emergency broadcast system. And you normally hear, this is the emergency broadcast system. This is a test. And it came on and it said, this is the emergency broadcast system. This is not a test. We are in a state of emergency. The levees have broken in New Orleans. And I knew then that New Orleans had been destroyed. In Pontchartrain Park, it was in some of the deepest part of the flooding. And we weren't able to get back in for about 8 weeks. But when we returned, it was like a nuclear holocaust. Just everything had been destroyed, gray. There was no green.
You took your parents back.
I took my parents back, and as we came up to the house, they just were destroyed. It was like losing the member of a family. I can hear my father's wailing. He said, we raised our sons in this house. We raised our sons in this house. And I'll never forget the power and the impact of my parents at that point in their life losing everything. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It seems so final. Here they are considering the end of their own lives at that age. And it's then that you look at your home and look at your memorabilia. And now at that point in their life, it was all destroyed. And when I saw how painful it was for them, I said, before they die, I want to get them back in this home. And I did that. And we got back into the home about a year and a half later.
In that moment, looking at your parents in their grief, what were your feelings? That was the house you grew up in, you know, that's yeah. Your identity.
It was very painful. I've seen my parents in grief once before when my older brother died. He died about 5 years before. I saw them just tortured in grief and pain and loss. And I saw them become these diminutive, fragile souls. And then I saw it again that day when I brought them to the house. And I knew that if I demolished the home and had an empty lot, it probably would demolish them. So I told the contractor, I said, I know this is going to sound stupid and crazy. I said, I don't want to ever see the lot empty. So we rebuilt from the inside out so we can keep some semblance of home. And all I knew was I needed to get them back into the home or they would die.
And you did it. It was one of the first of a series of actions. You know, I said at the beginning mm-hmm. that you were inspired by that experience to act in a number of different ways. Another one was in 2007. That was when you staged Waiting for Godot in two different locations among yes. New Orleans' most devastated areas. Why did you want to be part of that production?
Well, there was a picture of two men in the middle of the devastation and the flood calling for help to the Coast Guard helicopters that were flying above. And the director said, I saw Dee Dee and Gogo, and asked me to be a part of it. We did it with on the stage filled with 15,000 gallons of water and a rooftop coming out of the water. And then they asked us to bring it to New Orleans. And I said, we should do it in the Lower Ninth Ward, which was at the heart of the devastation. And it was there that so many people had died. And it was so emblematic of what was happening to us in New Orleans. So people from different classes, different races, different walks of life. And in one moment in the play, I stood there and really broke character and just turned to people in the audience and said the lines, at this place, in this moment of time, all mankind is us. Let us do something while we have the chance. We owed it to those who had come before to make sure that we rebuilt and rebuilt better. And that's when I put together Pontchartrain Park Community Development Corp to rebuild my neighborhood house by house. To date, we've rebuilt 40 houses.
It's time for your seventh disc.
My seventh disc is emblematic of that hope that is so much a part of the American aesthetic. And this is Americana. It also makes me think of my mother because she was so hopeful. And if I'm going to be alone on an island, I need that optimism and hope. And this is the seventh movement of Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland.
Part of the seventh movement of Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, performed by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein.
And I remember when we moved back to Pontchartrain Park and so many people had come back. My mother was still alive. I got them home before they died. And I got the Louisiana Philharmonic to come to our neighborhood. And I asked them to play this. And forever, that moment and that piece of music will be defined by the realization that we were back. We had suffered through the worst and had returned home. The sense of home and the sense of optimism of what was to come. And so whenever I hear that, I think of how we came back.
Wendell Pierce, you're obviously a hugely reflective passionate person by nature.
Yeah.
And at the minute, you're here in the UK on stage, taking on the role of Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. What kind of impact has that role had on you? Living with that part and thinking about, you know, a life, what a life means, the limitations that might be placed on that life.
It has affected me deeply. Doing this play, while it's as difficult as anything I could have imagined, this play deals with a man's insecurities, and fears, wondering if his best days are behind him. What has he accomplished in life? And trying to find a way to give it purpose and finding redemption. It serves the purpose of what art should always be, the forum where we collectively come together and reflect on who we are and declare what our values are and act on them in a purposeful way with a purposeful life. What thoughts are to the individual, art should be for the community as a whole, where we are moved to reflect and change our lives, ultimately for the better, but for the common good. Willie is looking for something outside of himself to give him validity, be liked by so many others, and you will never want. No. Love and like yourself, and you will never want. The power that he has, the beauty of his life is within himself. All the qualities of the man, of the father, of the husband that he wants to be is a powerful thing that's coming from within and not from the outside. And the ability to find that within is what Willie misses.
And is that a realization that you've been able to get to in your life?
I've come to the understanding I have a problem with the execution. It's that simple. But every day gives me an opportunity to try to get it right.
We've got one more disc to go.
And this is spirituality. It is eternal. It speaks to all humanity. And it's ultimately what I believe spirit is, and that's love. And this is A Love Supreme by John Coltrane. Part one, an acknowledgement.
A Love Supreme, Part 1, An Acknowledgement, John Coltrane. It sounds so much cooler when you say it, Wendell Pierce.
John Coltrane.
Coltrane. I can't carry that off.
Oh, man, that will sustain you on a desert island.
Yes. Well, speaking of which, I'm about to cast you away to yours. What will you do when you arrive?
Wow. Wait a minute now. I didn't know that was a part of the examination of my soul, which this therapy session has been. I will bathe. I will take a bath in the water of the ocean. I imagine this aqua green, warm Caribbean desert island I've been placed on. I will wash away whatever trauma has brought me to this predicament.
And when you've done that, you'll have the books that you can start on to keep you busy. We'll give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You can also have a book of your choice. What would you like?
Albert Murray, the Omni-Americans. You can see I'm proud of my people, my family. I'm going to hang on to that because it's about African Americans, the contribution they made to the human diaspora, to Western civilization. So that would be my book.
You can also have a luxury item.
Oh, it would be easy. I'm from New Orleans. I cook.
Mm.
And I know how to do seafood. So okay. I would have a grill.
Ah.
So that we would have all kinds of wonderful grilled shrimp and lobster. And I would be able to grow some beans and make some red beans and rice and all of that. I would be able to cook some wonderful meals on this grill. That would be my luxury item.
Then it's yours. And if you could only save one of these eight fantastic tracks that you've played us today, which would it be?
Mahalia Jackson's voice is singularly one of the most brilliant sounds ever to be heard on this earth. Body and soul, and that's what I would love to have forever. So that's the one I would save.
Wendell Pierce, thank you so much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you for my therapy session. I am fully prepared to go back to rehearsing. Thank you so much for having me.
I loved meeting Wendell and listening to the story of his life. His love of New Orleans and appreciation of jazz shone through. Many jazz musicians have been cast away over the years, including Courtney Pine, Earl Hines, Dave Brubeck and Humphrey Lyttleton. But back in 1968, another famous son of New Orleans was cast away by Roy Plumley, jazz trumpeter and innovator Louis Armstrong.
Satch, both you and jazz were born in New Orleans, Louisiana, right?
That's right, Bob. That's the way it should be worded, because that's where when I was 5 years old, I used to hear Buddy Bolden. And
you heard Buddy Bolden?
Yeah, well, they used to play on the sidewalk before they go into the Funky Butt Hall on Saturday nights. So we couldn't go in there, we're too young, but we could hear that half hour they play before they go in.
Mm-hmm.
So when people pass by, they stop in and hear a few sets on their way home.
This was a great come-on to get the people in.
Yeah.
How far could Buddy Bolden be heard? Right across the city?
Well, I mean, he allowed me here from here to Sheffield.
Satch, it'd be an understatement, I think, to call your childhood underprivileged. You were brought up in the back of town district, in Shantytown.
Yeah, around the honky-tonks.
When did you get a chance to learn music, to learn to play an instrument?
Well, in the orphanage, when I was in the orphanage, you know, for shooting my father's gun, celebrating New Year's Eve, you know.
This was just for fun.
Everybody shoot their guns, but if they get caught, that's a different story, and I got caught. Yeah. So I stayed in the orphanage home, which they called Colored Wave Home for Boys,
mm-hmm.
and they had a little band there, and first they made me the drummer, and they handed me the bugle. That's when I really shine, because they couldn't eat, they couldn't do nothing that I blow them different calls, you know?
Yeah. You played on the riverboats, too?
Yes, sir.
Whose band was that?
Fate Marable's band.
Mm.
Yeah, from 1919 to 1921. We used to play at the foot of Canal Street during the winter, and then we go up the river all the way up to Davenport Highway.
Yes.
And that's where I first met Big Spiderbat. He's a little kid just coming up with his horn. He's come on the boat.
Mm-hmm. He used to come and listen to you.
Yeah, and we used to sit around and blow a little. That's when I found out he could play that piano in a miss.
Mm, that was a great
record. Lovely kid.
What was the first break you had as a musician? Joining King Oliver, was it?
Well, I think all whatever I ever done in music was my breaks, because I never did look back after I left the offices.
Mm.
You know, I used to play in all them good top horn players' place when they want to get off.
Yeah.
I'd say, send little Louie in my place. I was a little bit of fella, you know. Never did weigh over 120 pounds. I don't know where I picked up all that weight, eating all the cabbage and
anyway, Louie, King Oliver sent for you from Chicago.
Yeah, 1922, and I was just finishing up a funeral with the Tuxedo Brass Band when I got the telegram.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't go home. I just went right to the IC station. Mama had fixed up that little fixed sandwich from the steak with me, you know.
This was another useful
1920,
little...
1920. That's about the highlights of all of it.
Mm. But playing in funerals was another useful source of income, as well as the hunting.
That's our life, that funeral.
Yeah.
We play a funeral march and you stand there, watch it pass, and tears come out your eyes.
The unmistakable voice of Louis Armstrong. Just amazing. Talking to Roy Plumley in 1968. You can hear that programme and over 2,000 other editions of Desert Island Discs on BBC Sounds and on our website. Next time, my guest will be TV scriptwriter Russell T. Davis. Do join us then.
Here's a question. A man escapes from one of the world's most brutal dictatorships. He's risked everything to do it. But once he's free, he digs a hole and he tunnels straight back in again. Why? I'm Helena Merriman, and over the past 6 months, I've been investigating an extraordinary escape story for BBC Radio 4. A story involving a tunnel, a spy, and an American TV network. To subscribe, search for Intrigue, Tunnel 29 on BBC Sounds.